Welcome to episode 10 of the Intersections on the Spectrum podcast. The Intersections on the Spectrum podcast is the brainchild of Doug Bletcher and Kelly Brown Johnson, created to discuss intersectional issues within the autistic community and give visibility to commonly marginalized, repressed, underrepresented, or erased identities and issues. We aim to introduce you to the people and stories you didn't know about but needed to hear, and hope that by seeing yourself represented in the community allows you to feel seen.
It's hard to believe it's been 10 episodes already. It goes quick. Yes. 10 great episodes. This will be the 10th great episode. And joining us today is talented artist Angela Weddle. Angela, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Wanted to start out by learning about your identities. What would you say your identities are that describe you?
Well, I always joke that I am a member of so many minorities that I could have my own UN membership. I mean, I'm Black, I'm biracial, I'm queer, I'm autistic, I'm physically disabled, cerebral palsy, and various chronic pain and fibromyalgia. I have right hemisphere brain damage, and even queer is a whole thing. I mean, I've at various times have come out as trans, and I don't even know, I didn't go through with that, but I my gender is kind of whatever, my sexuality, and so I kind of feel like I hit all the bases.
It's a jackpot.
yes.
So, how do you feel that all these different intersections affect your life?
You know, I don't know if I think, I mean, in terms of intersections, not in a day-to-day sense. I mean, obviously they're there, they exist, and when, I guess, one of them comes up, you know, you kind of think about it. So if you're getting flack for, you know, whether it's being disabled, being Black, whatever. But I mean, most of the time, it's kind of really hard to separate them. They're kind of all rolled into one, and I guess if I had to say the biggest way it impacts my life is poverty. Poverty, medical care, education, you know, growing up, you know, I made a big deal about my intelligence, and I wasn't diagnosed at the time. Even with cerebral palsy, that can be rare, but didn't get diagnosed until I was an adult, and so I was diagnosed with other things. And then when I turned 18 and went to college and just kind of, you know, hit this wall with all these expectations, and then learning, oh, wait, there's really no place for you here. You know, sort of like, you're brilliant, we can't teach you because you have the wrong kind of mind, you know, and there's no accommodations for right hemisphere brain damage, for right hemisphere and math-based learning disabilities. I mean, it's kind of like, I guess, where dyslexia was at one time, and it's still not great for people who are dyslexic, but definitely it's sort of like all my talents were in the wrong areas as far as it's like, okay, you know, you get to this point, there's not really the accommodations, and more time on tests was an answer. And then I sort of realized, you know, because I was sort of naive, went into college like, oh, this is about learning. No, this is not about learning. This is like economic gatekeeping. You know, I mean, it should be about learning. You know, I was there to learn, but I realized, oh, this is economic gatekeeping, and I'm kept out of this now. And so, I mean, in that sense, and it's not just universities, it's the whole thing, intergenerational trauma. My mother's neurodiverse, my mother's Black, I grew up in Black culture, I didn't really know my father, and all of the dynamics, not just in my family personally, but so many Black families, you know, the things that people do to, I guess, transcend their situation are not always good. They're at the expense of other people, you know, in their families. My mom and I bore a lot of the brunt of that, you know, and then if you don't, we don't have as much social capital to start, you know, as some people do. And then when you have disabilities with it, and you have eight, and then it's kind of this whole effect of, you know, sometimes I think, well, why didn't I cut class? I did all the right things, only to be in a position I feel like I could have been if I would have just blown everything off. And so even poverty is kind of not even the right word. It's just very, it's the whole systemic thing. It's not just, oh, fear of police, fear of being arrested, or all those things. It's this feeling of never being able to have autonomy fully.
It's super, you know, it's vulnerable, and it's also, it's scary because you don't, complete lack of control over your life and being able to predict everything. Something that kind of struck out to me, I recently applied for an American university, and my only reference is that I previously applied and went to a Canadian university, and in the application for the American university, they were asking me about my parents' education, and I was like, why does that have to do with anything, right? And
right,
you know, like my,
yeah, exactly,
like, and I'm like, how is this? And I'm 40 years old now. Like,
I'll be 38 at the end of this month. So yeah, I know what you mean.
And I was like, and my dad's dead. So what difference does it make? Mm. Like, you know, and he's the one who went to university. Good for him. But my mom didn't. My mom never even finished high school. But what does that have to do with me?
It shouldn't have anything. And that's also, you know, something I don't think my dad, I don't know what he did or didn't do, but my mom did, you know, some college, some community college, but she didn't get, you know, finish a 4-year degree. Mm-hmm. Not that it matters, but that's part of the social capital. I mean, even when you think about job references, being autistic, you know, I have friends now, but even now the actual people I can count in person, you know, but for a long time when I was younger, I didn't have references. I had no references. You know, everyone's like, you can't be a trustworthy person when some people don't have references. It's right. Not because they're not trustworthy, and those social things I saw a man on the street, the police were asking him, don't you have any family? No, he didn't. He was old. He didn't have, not everyone has those things we just assume everyone has. And then that's not even going to the things that definitely not everyone has.
Angela, I always like people that think differently, because if not, this, I think the world would be a really boring place. So, and I read that you didn't get your autism diagnosis until you were an adult, unfortunately, like many people. But growing up, everyone knew you were different. When you were 4 years old, instead of being content just to watch Sesame Street, you were also watching Charlie Rose. What was it about Charlie that drew your attention to him and his interviews?
And I did watch Sesame Street, but and I can still tell you what the show was about. It was about international relations. And I guess, it's weird. At that, I wasn't even supposed to be watching him. I was epileptic growing up, and he was coming around midnight on the PBS station, which normally I wouldn't be up at the time. But the medicine they had given me, I guess it was having some negative side effects, so I was just not sleeping. I was awake. And he came on, and I must have seen him at my grandmother's at some point, maybe at some other time. And so, you know, I asked my mom to keep it on. But beyond just that, I guess, for one, I liked the all-black background. You know, most talk shows, if you watched it, there was all of this kind of noise, the audience clapping, this whole, a lot of stimulation. And it was just him and, you know, the subject and kind of that background and that intro music. And I guess maybe there was something soothing about that. I liked the sound of his voice. Always kind of been, you know, gravitated to maybe voices of people that were interesting, maybe not typically, I don't know, whatever the typical sexy or whatever voices, but, you know, interesting voices. And the subject, I was always, I mean, you know, you would think, well, what does a 4-year-old know about international relations? But I was already telling everyone not to vote for Reagan at Christmas dinner. So, I mean, I was just always interested in the world. It didn't matter if I didn't understand everything, you know, but, and so I didn't believe in this concept of, I wanted to, and the funny thing is I really wanted to be as an adult as a child. I thought I would have control over my life. Somebody should have said that was a lie. And I was not very into things that were for children for the most part for my age, especially intellectually. So it was just I almost thought I could have this super awareness, this mind over matter thing. I really believed in that and getting as much, to me, adult knowledge. And nobody told me, just like, it wasn't my mother or any adult, but somehow in my mind, I thought I would have control if I could kind of get all this knowledge about the world.
No, that makes sense. I think a lot of us are people watchers, like to try and make sense of things, try to understand why people do things. I think that's why a lot of the autistic people I know, the women that I know especially, really love crime shows and understanding serial killers, because I think you're trying to figure out what makes somebody do that, and how can you predict if anybody on the street is one of these, you know? And I think...
Yes, and I actually have met a mass murderer, which was a very bizarre thing to do as a child.
Wow.
Yeah, so my mom was an officer and a tough job, and person who was... woman who would later go on to be arrested for this mass killing, who should have never been hired. And I could tell even then, even it was very brief, she didn't do me, but it was very, the brief encounter, but I could see then there was some, it was a nice, it just was not, you know. And I don't remember really being afraid, because I know my mom would, there just was no way, you know, like nothing was, my mom wouldn't let anything touch me, but it was more that knowledge of people like this exist. And that was before the crimes had happened, so.
And I think that's a one way that we kind of maybe keep ourselves safe to some extent, too, by being able to recognize
right. people. But that wasn't even what I was afraid of. I mean, I grew up being bullied constantly for not fitting in, being too white, being not black enough, being whatever, and kind of always in the margins and having to physically fight a lot. And for me, it wasn't, I think for me, my draw to things like crime shows wasn't so much, how do I keep myself safe? I think there's a capacity in anyone to kind of go over these edges and, you know, people like to think they can't. And so I just found it interesting, because once you've had to, it doesn't matter if it's self-defense, once you're in any kind of situation where you're kind of involved in any violence, trying to figure out your own roles and capacities in that. I found the complexity of the idea of guilt and innocence to be, I think, trying to figure out that, and also trying to predict, maybe not so much with crime shows as involved, but even as a child, predict who was going to be safe, who was going to believe, who was going to be violent, who was just going to call names, which for me was like, whatever, and who was... And then even into adult behaviors or certain things. So I was just watching everything and making this mental Rolodex of behaviors, you know. And it was less so much those extreme things like, oh, somebody might kill me or that kind of thing, but more the day-to-day traumas that I was trying to predict.
I totally relate to that, and it's an interesting skill to have, like, because like you said, I was bullied too, and it's about teasing out, okay, who can I ignore, who do I need to kind of de-escalate with, you know, who do I need to, okay, if you're just gonna call me names, okay, cool, no problem, I'll just keep walking, whatever. I totally and I think that has served me really well, especially when I travel. Like, I've traveled by myself around the world, and you know, I've been in situations where I've been grabbed and things like that. And it's kind of that's a really handy skill to have, as bad as
the funny thing is, people talk, you know, like to say we don't have social skills. And I was telling a friend recently, I think I had better boundaries as a child in some ways than as an adult. And I was like, as a child, especially before diagnosis, you're kind of very blunt, and it's like, you know, can I have those chips? No, you know, or whatever. And it's not even, for me, it wasn't even about fitting in. I didn't care about being hated or whatever. I think you just get tired, you get worn down. And when you're an adult, and this is also where the gatekeeping comes in. If I kick somebody off as a kid, even if I have to fight, I don't care if somebody hits me so much. Like, that's my, I still didn't feel my life was in danger, maybe in the same way as an adult, because now anything you say or do can economically, it's worse than being hit in a way.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And so it's sort of like, you know, if you defend yourself or school says something, whatever, you know, your parents are there to kind of help. Now it's an adult, I'm on my own. And then also seeing my mother kind of work 40 years in various professions, and for what? We're still like, in, you know, and she's certainly worse off than she was, you know, at those times. And being neurodiverse, and then it's just, you know, maybe when I was like 18, 20, in my 20s, I was sort of like, oh yeah, you know, screw the system, kind of. But then you get older and it's not that simple. It's not like you have to live with people. And And so for me, it sort of became this thing of, okay, now I can't, you know, I have PTSD from a lot of things, those early experiences, other things, but it's, you know, hard to, sometimes I'm too reactive, sometimes I'm not reactive enough. And as a kid, I think those boundaries were very clear. And then over time, you start thinking, well, am I too judgmental? Am I too this? You know, people say that. Mm-hmm. You get in relationships. And now that I'm getting closer to 40, so I'm going back around, no, I mean, maybe I was kind of right, you know, and those things. And it's a very kind of hard thing to balance out because there's not a template for how to, I guess, how to live, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought there was a template, maybe, and I kept looking for people who were well-adjusted or people. The more I met people, I don't care if they had a PhD, I don't care if they were professors, I don't care if they looked like they had it together. Everyone, you spend enough time with them, and you can see. And so then it's like, oh, nobody knows what they're doing? And yeah, that wasn't really good. It's like, how do I figure this out? Yeah. It didn't make me feel better. It just made me feel like everyone's pretending. And so then I started realizing some people are just higher masking than others.
I have that same view where I say everybody shits and stinks. So, like, don't even start.
Yes.
Don't even try and argue with me because I'm just like, no.
But it is an interesting skill. Yeah, because like you said, even with that, you know, even if I was maybe ignoring my intuition, you know, or maybe I'm not reading the social cue, like, right, one-on-one, but I had that intuition, regardless of whether I recognized your tone of voice or something. And so I think, like you said, when I listen to that intuition, that's really powerful, and when I have, it's been really protective, like you said, whether it's traveling or whatever.
I want to touch on something else you said. Is that okay? Like, do you mind?
Cause no, it's okay. I'm sorry. I'm a tangential person. It's hard.
Okay, no, but I kind of want to go with the flow of what we're talking about, because you touched on so many amazing points that are just, like, so resonant with my life, so I just wanted to check if that's okay.
No, that's cool with me.
Okay. Yeah, because something, you know, I want to talk a bit about your experience being biracial, because I am as well. My father immigrated to Canada from Barbados, and my mom is French-Canadian. So I've always felt that I had to straddle these two worlds of both English, French, black, white, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and that kind of that concept of not being black enough or not being or being too white or whatever, you know, like,
yes,
that kind of lateral violence that we get. So we're not just getting discrimination from white people. We're getting. And not just discrimination. I also got some erasure too, where they'd be like, well, I didn't think you were black. Like, I forgot you were black. And like, so I just kind of want to talk about that and share those kind of experiences, because I'm not sure that everybody really knows what that's like unless they're like us, pretty much.
No, I you know, I'm from New Orleans. So even on, so I'm Creole, it's very, you know, I think you have that Caribbean influence, you have, you know, kind of that similar. And in some ways, New Orleans is a really interesting place because, you know, this whole history of racial mixing, but it was a very, but same time, and actually just interesting, even with Black Lives Matter, so all the things going on now, and sometimes the rhetoric is very, not just, it's very, you know, so it's not anti-racist, but, you know, but there was this understanding between Black people, white people in some ways that may not satisfy some of the people now, but for instance, my mom was 77, and I think it's a very hard thing to understand unless you've lived it, you know, why people make certain decisions and why, you know, and it's not just because, oh, my mom's generation didn't have a cell phone or a smartphone. I don't think maybe as much of the, what people, I don't really like the term cancel culture, but what people call that would have happened in the same way then, because everyone was connected, but it was just a very different thing. But at the same time, growing up, I think what hurt me the most, it was almost like I didn't care about racism from white people, like it was there, but it was like whatever, you expected it. I think it was far more hurtful to get it from my own,
right?
And to have, basically I felt like everything I did was perceived as white. I mean, even with the cerebral palsy, which in question I guess how does it intersect with autism, well, for instance, I didn't learn until I was an adult that autistic people don't always pick up on the accents of their dominant culture. So whatever culture you grow up in, you don't always pick up on those ways of speaking. So people always said I didn't sound like I'm from New Orleans, or I didn't sound black. And there's like 9 different dialects in New Orleans, so it's a very rich city linguistically anyhow. So it wasn't merely just speaking white. It's not picking up on, but even my movements. We didn't know NCP, so, you know, in cultures that were very movement-based, dance-based, I couldn't. And I think CP was, it wasn't seen as CP, it was seen as I was dancing like a white girl. When I can't physically move my body, I can't clap on beat, it's neurological, I can't move in those ways. It's not a rejection of you know, the music or the movement. It's, and but nobody knew that, and, you know, children didn't. So I think it was very difficult because the ways I process information, it's like, and I also was, I use words literally. If I said you people, I meant you as people, not, you know, the, so, and it was very hard to understand the history. And I didn't understand why I had to be bound, or why any individual, not just me, had to be bound by any constructs of society. We should all be free to be. And now that's, when I read these discussions online, now that gets you labeled a Karen, that gets you labeled, you know, deliberately clueless, naive, or, you know, like you can't really believe that, or you're stupid, or you're racist. And I guess the saddest thing, I read this, I can't remember his name, but there was a figure I read about, there was a, something I read online about an autistic man who was a slave. And I wish I could remember his name. I think he had intellectual delay. And the article talked about how he had almost transcended that circumstance because he didn't understand what was going on. And I think he was blind and could play piano or some kind of...
Wow, okay.
And so, in a way, he had more freedom than everyone else because he was, you know, kind of being used for his talent. And even though, you know, I can understand what's going on, so I don't have an intellectual delay in that sense, I think I really not just really didn't understand race in that sense. I understood race in the sense of, you know, my mother obviously talked to me. I mean, I remember when I had a tantrum or in Mobile when I was 4 and this white guy knocked on the door and she had to, in the hotel, and she had to make him go away, and she shut the door and she said, girl, don't you know this is a lynching town? And I'm like, what's lynching? And so she explained to me, and then I started crying because I felt like, oh, I can't even be a child. I'm going to get my family killed. And, you know, I'm 4 and I knew how white looking I was. You know, I mean, I could, anyone's white baby, I was so white looking. And there's my, you know, black grandmother and black mother, and I don't want to get her killed just because I wanted to go shopping, you know. And so I understood race in that sense, but I thought, but in other ways, I didn't understand, I think, the full cultural implications of it. And I think the saddest thing for me is realizing you can't transcend race, not just because of white racism and white people, but because of how it's affected black and indigenous people of color. It's so internalized that we're all hurting and acting in ways sometimes beneficial, sometimes hurtful, because of this embedded trauma to each other. Yeah. So it's like if you try to do something, it's like, oh, it's seen as racist, even if it's not. If you try to transcend, you know, it's like, you talk about race, someone's getting upset, you're talking about it too much. If you don't talk about it, someone's getting upset because you're not talking about it enough. And if you actually just aren't aware, you're blamed for that too. So the hardest thing for me is I felt like there was not only no place, but no one could ever assume good intent or whatever. Whatever I did, I feel like I have to be very direct, almost like I have to announce. And I never tried to pass anyhow, but I feel like I have to be very, like, hey, I'm black, like, I need a billboard. Like, I'm actually kind of worried when my mother dies. Like, I feel like I'm going to have to wear a t-shirt of her everywhere, but just so I won't, it's something, it's, you know, it's sort of like, I feel like I have to constantly make it known where I stand, and I can just kind of never move through life the way I could, maybe if I had a single identity, where people just knew, you know, okay. And that's been in every space, where there's, even when I came out of lesbian, which I wish I wouldn't have come out so early. I wish I would have given myself time to not commit to an identity so early. But even with that, and kind of realizing, oh, maybe my identities are more fluid. But even with that, every single identity I felt like I had to kind of go all in on. But my identity never fits in a box neatly. So it's never, oh, that's female, that's a female, that's a you know, she's a lesbian, she's black, or, you know, whatever. I'm always kind of navigating. The good thing about that is people are people. Humans, you get to see the good and the bad of everything. And I think it's really, it can be hard to explain nuances to people who don't want to hear those nuances when we are very, when our identities become everything to us, you know?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's made me very realistic about expectations from anybody.
You know, Angela, I wanted to make note that the article you were talking about, I believe it was a few years ago in the New York Times about the blind autistic pianist who was a slave. So people can kind of look that up online.
Yes, thank you. I thank you for mentioning where it was, because there were a couple of different, you know, things mentioned on it, but I couldn't remember where.
Yeah. Before going, I know you're a talented artist. For people that want to learn about your art and where to purchase it, can you tell them a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's my, for most of my digital art and things, my pixels.site, so Angela-Weddle, Weddle.pixels.com. They can also follow me on Instagram at aweddle83, you know, message me. So definitely, those are the two main places right now. And if they want anything that's a physical piece, or just message me on Instagram.
All right. Well, Angela, really appreciate your time today. I have a feeling me and Kelly could have talked to you for another hour or two.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go off the questions too much.
No, it's fine. It's for me, it's fine, as long as people are cool to go with the flow.
Because, yeah.
I really want, you know, it's your story that needs to be shared. So.
Yeah. No, I feel like the other. If I could just say one more thing, maybe. You know, though I don't regret any of it. I mean, I've never wanted to be white or to be not. You know, I mean, I could do without the chronic pain, but I've never wanted to not be autistic or whatever. I think it's just all a way of looking at the world, and I think it's forced me to, you know, really, you have to sort of let go of any anger. You have to make a choice, and I think it's really forced me to reckon with things, maybe, you know, that could be swept under the rug otherwise, and it's really a gift. I think it informs everything, you know, everything I do. So even things like, even though there are plenty of times I'm afraid, oh, what am I going to do? You know, if something happens to my mother, what am I going to do without social capital? What am I going to do without financial? I think it puts you in spaces to, I think there's a question about how autistic people would, you know, how could they be successful as an artist? Or I think at any field, almost every autistic and neurodiverse person I know has to take a non-traditional path. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, having maybe all these identities that intersect forces, I don't think you can take a traditional path when you're like we are. I think it's, and maybe that's a good thing. You know, I think growing up, going back to the Charlie Rose question, I wanted it to be linear, right? I thought mind over matter. I thought I could do this, and do the right things. And then all that got blown up with chronic pain and other things. But I think it's a more honest path. You learn you don't have control, but you also learn how to deal with it.
I like that a lot. I think, yeah, it makes us like almost like shapeshifters that we...
Yes, I feel very much, and it can be difficult too. That's its own thing, like, who are you, you know, sort of. And especially for somebody like me, I've always been, I don't know you, but I've always been super obsessed with honesty. And it took me a long time to, especially as a growing up, to learn the difference between honesty and the truth and what the people meant by filters. And, you know, like if you changed your, I couldn't understand, what do you mean you changed your mind growing up? That was a lie. You said you were going to do something and you didn't. Now, you know, so it took a long time to navigate that, and now I've become so nuanced about things. It's almost sometimes, can autistic people be this nuanced? Yes, we can. You know, it's sort of like, you know, kind of separating the medical literature from when you have the lived experiences that are full of these identities that intersect. It has to be nuanced.
What a beautiful note to leave that on. I think it's amazing.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking to both of you.